This week on Life and Faith.
What we've seen is that poverty is a comorbidity. We know old age is, and having a prior medical condition, but with this virus, we're now seeing poverty is a comorbidity. And the vulnerable, the poor, are those who are most impacted. That's who charities exist for. It's why lots of churches that meet and take up a collection plate each Sunday and do something for their homeless are so important in this community.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. They just get their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker. Nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart and I'm with Tim Costello. Well, I'm not really with Tim Costello. He's in Melbourne. I'm in Sydney. Good to see you, Tim.
Good to see you, Simon. We're up early and wondering, is that another Groundhog Day? They start to blur into each other when you're only in your home.
It does, doesn't it? Are you surviving down there? How is it?
Oh, look, I am incredibly grateful for having moved a year ago. So I'm in Frankston, right on the beach. So I look out on the sea, I plunge into the water and swim. So my isolation's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, good. Well, that's good. Yeah, well, we're not too bad. We're all packed in here, teenagers in the house, you know, wife working at home, I'm working at home. So it's a little bit crowded, but we're coping so far.
Absolutely. I think of parents who basically are in a very small apartment and maybe teenage kids. I remember my youngest was a rat bag and a runaway, a tearaway. He's now a teacher. But my wife and I said, imagine being in the house we were in St Kilda when he was 15, 16 and tearing up the tracks. It would have been pretty tough.
Yeah, it's a really difficult period for lots of people. And you wrote a lovely article recently in The Guardian about a bunch of things, but one of the things was you were talking about how there's a lot of, we have to recognize, even while we try to look for the bright side and you know, think of good practices to help us through this, there's some real loss associated with this period, isn't there?
Deep loss, and you know, some of it's very, very personal. Reflect on how for the first two or three weeks I was just a caged lion. I've gone to every disaster on the planet in the last 16 years, and so my whole MO was I'm a helper, I can rescue, I can organize, I can do something. And there is a disaster everywhere on the planet. There's no normal where you can go to and help others and organize. No. And personal in the sense that I started to realize deep loss in my sense of identity. You know, here was my father who went off to war in New Guinea, and I'm told at 65, just sit on the couch because you're a risk to others.
Right, and to yourself, yeah.
And that's a loss. That's a deep loss in my sense of identity. So what good am I? I'm useless, and I've had to learn again. I can pray, I can listen. But lamenting the fact that I can't go to my coffee shop and get my morning paper, lamenting that I can't see my mother who's 91, and the deep fear behind that is I may never see her again because of this lockdown. She's 91 and frail. And then the stories of loss of friends I'm hearing, it intensifies the grief. And I imagine you're experiencing that too.
Yeah, when we, you know, just very conscious of people's difficulties at a more, you know, trivial level. My own daughter's in the last year of school, and there's a lot of, she's looking at the loss of whole lot of important markers in that, you know, important last year. So there's those little things, getting to more serious things like some other friends of ours who are getting married. I've had two friends now whose marriage has had to take place with a very minimal group of people. Normally, that's a big celebration with all your friends. So they're big sadnesses for people, big losses. And then I think you mentioned in your article, even worse than that, is when people have funerals now and can only have a few people along. I think that's a really, really sad disappointment there.
Yeah, I remember the night when the Prime Minister announced no more than 10, and I got a text. It was sort of facetious from a friend who's a minister who said, "Bag's not dying soon. I want more than 10 at my funeral."
Right. Well, yeah.
But it struck me that the funeral is that sense of where the legacy and the significance of your life is told. The grief is expressed in hugging, in solidarity, in the wake afterwards of telling anecdotes and just honouring the dignity of a life. And that, I think, is a huge loss. So many friends of mine who've had parents in this time die have put off even having a service. They're saying, "We will wait because we really want to honour this person's life with the physical presence." But I can only imagine what the waiting does to you. It bottles up grief. You haven't closed the circle. You haven't laid them to rest. You haven't said, "This person evoked in me feelings no one else can evoke, and I won't have those feelings anymore, and I don't have anyone to share that with." So I think that funeral one is very deep.
Yeah, it really is. And the thought of people also dying alone is just anguish, isn't it? When you think of someone you really love who you can't, normally the whole, if you get the opportunity to be at the bedside of someone to share the last thoughts, and the thought of these people in this COVID-19 period dying, necessarily dying on their own, is a truly tragic thing.
I agree, Simon. The fundamental thing about existence is we aren't born alone, and no one should die alone. And when you think about it, the existential grief is that when you're born, you didn't ask to be here. No one actually explains the meaning of life. You have to stumble through and try and work it out. And you have that existential weight. And death brings that existential meaning question back. What has been the meaning? And I'm going, and I'm near the end, if you've got time to know it. And not to have someone physically there with you in those last stages, I think really robs us of something profoundly human.
Tim, do you think that this period will... It's very hard to predict anything at the moment, isn't it? But do you think it will help us as a community, as groups of people, to reprioritize things or rethink our priorities and what's important and where we can spend our time and energy, that type of thing?
Yeah, I really do. Look, I think there is a fork in the road, and that fork, there is a higher road and a lower road. The lower road is just get this over and I'll snap back to doing everything I did. The higher road is to actually say, I learnt what actually really matters. In my Guardian article that you quote, I quoted Adam Lindsay Gordon, one of our great poets, who said, "Life is mainly froth and bubble. Two things stand like stone. Kindness in another's trouble, courage in your own." And I think we have seen kindness and courage in this time. I think we've often reflected, there has been a lot of froth and bubble, a lot of hyperactivity, which when I actually was forced to lock down, I looked at and said, "Why was I doing that?"
Right.
So I think the higher road is actually to reflect on that. And I hope people personally take it, and I hope we as a nation take that higher road.
Do you think you're a Baptist pastor? You talk about faith in public all the time. Do you think this would be a time where people might perhaps to either reconsider questions of faith or return perhaps to the place of some faith where they might have left it behind for a long time? It's because it throws up all sorts of questions of mortality and meaning, doesn't it? In a way that we were pretty good at distracting ourselves in Australia, I think, from these kinds of deeper questions.
Yeah, I In principle, I think COVID-19 should be very good for the faith business. In principle, it is that pushing of the pause button to actually say, if I just focus on the quality of life, which has been our obsession, not the meaning of life, then I might miss who I am, why I'm here, in my Christian faith, why I need to align with my maker's, my creator's deepest purposes in order to flourish. So it should be good for the faith business. Look, we also know it's good for domestic violence. It's good for online gambling. It's good for people whose marriages might have been rocky, locked together. They find they're close and only further apart. So there's a whole lot of things that actually are thrown up in this crisis. But I do think the faith question is there at the front.
So, Tim, one of the real challenges, one areas of real challenge in this period is that facing charities. And you're very involved, obviously, in the charity sector, have been, and you're chairing this body that's looking at how to respond to the COVID crisis. What's happening to charities in this time?
Well, we formed the Charities Crisis Cabinet because charities were very fragmented, doing wonderful things, but never cutting through on the national agenda. By that, I mean, if you had a productivity commission looking into something, business would always be invited. The unions would always be invited. Of course, the politicians would be overseeing it. But the charity sector, that's 1.2 million Australians, that's 8% of GDP, that does so much of the heavy lifting in this nation, would never be invited to the table. And that's because we're so fragmented. We didn't really have a voice that was resonating with the size. And the Charities Crisis Cabinet's first achievement really was to be included in the stimulus package. The initial stimulus package, charities weren't even thought of because we are so invisible and under the radar. The second achievement has been to recognise that to qualify for JobKeeper, you only need as a charity to show 15%, not 30% of revenue loss. Why is that important? Because most of the revenue for charities is raised in this quarter, going up to June the 30th. And no one can run really fundraising events. No public events are allowed. The usual schedule of fundraising events in this quarter all have disappeared. Add, the public have flatlined in their giving. Well, they've just decreased it. They've kept their hand in their pocket. Understandably, they're anxious about their own financial future. So our books might have looked good up to December, but this 15% rather than 30% loss of revenue is good. Look, the final thing I'd say is it's a really critical time, not just for charities, but who they serve. Charities, 60% of them in Australia, don't have reserves to survive 6 months. 25-30% don't have reserves to survive 3 months. And why? Because the public expectation of charities is low overheads and low reserves. That's the test of whether you want to give. So charities have been caught, maybe hoisted on their own petard.
They necessarily have to. So do you think this is going? How are they going to be able to survive this? Like, what's going to happen?
Look, a number won't survive. And you know, the Charities Crisis Cabinet has bought some time, and we've been doing well before COVID-19 some rationalising, saying of the 60,000 charities in Australia, there is a lot of duplication. They could be sharing back offices. Some could be merging. And we only exist to do ourselves out of a job, really, to actually meet a need. So there has been thinking about how do we allow the good charities to survive, whose consumers, clients, people they serve need them, but some that could merge actually merge. And one of the things we've put to the government is what Britain has, a big Consolidation Fund. David Cameron, under his Great Society initiatives when he was Prime Minister in the UK, had this big fund that actually allowed charities to merge, to rationalise, to not duplicate. We haven't had that in Australia, so that's another line we're pursuing with the government.
And Tim, presumably it is the people on the margins, the most vulnerable people, who are going to particularly feel this crisis. How are you seeing that play out at the moment?
Yeah, look, what we've seen is that poverty is a comorbidity. We know old age is, and having a prior medical condition, but with this virus, we're now seeing poverty is a comorbidity. And the vulnerable, the poor, are those who are most impacted. That's who charities exist for. It's why lots of churches that meet and take up a collection plate each Sunday and do something for their homeless are so important in this community. They're the ones who are being impacted.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and I'm here with Tim Costello. Now, Tim, you told me about this supermarket initiative by a church in Melbourne, Planet Shakers, which has been a really useful thing for quite a while now, but it's particularly relevant today, isn't it?
It's quite remarkable. Their charitable arm called Empower of Planet Shakers has been caring for many of the vulnerable, and with now six effective warehouse supermarkets where they give people dignity to choose what they need. They have been inundated. And again, it's really this question that's hovering over Australia. The motto is, we're all in this together. And then we find, actually, what about those who are casual labourers? What about those on temporary protection visas? What about international students? And what Empower with their supermarkets is discovering is that often middle-class students and casual workers are desperately hungry and needy.
Well, let's hear from Neil Smith. He's the International Director of Planet Shakers, and he explains what this initiative is all about.
Look, we could see, as you can all see, 6 weeks ago we were living normal life. Today it's very different, and we could see that things were rapidly closing down. And for about 10 years, we've had a program called The Pantry through our, charitable arm, which is called Empower. And basically been feeding around about 200 to 250 people a week. But the way we do it that I guess is a point of difference is we've set up where they gather their food from. Rather than just give people a bag of food, we actually have the opportunity to set it up like a supermarket so that they come in, and they would choose like they would at the supermarket. And of course, it's what's available, but we try to have a wide variety. And they walk through and they get to choose what they feel they need. And we think that contributes not just to giving them food, but also to human dignity, that they feel like they're not just shoved something and here, take that, but they actually get the right opportunity to choose for their family. So we started 4 weeks ago, decided that we would ramp it up. And we have six locations that we do church. So we decided in four of those locations that we would increase when everything else was decreasing. Bit of a risk, in our faith paradigm, we'd say it was a faith step. But we stepped out and we spent nearly $60,000 creating four extra locations. And to our amazement, I'm not sure this is a good thing. It's good in the sense of the need being met, but in the context of the people, not so good. So we went from averaging 250 people to last weekend, we had over 1,600 people visit our five locations.
And what sort of difference are you noticing in terms of that, the makeup of the clientele?
Yeah. Look, a lot of the people are, I can only say this, one, because of discussion, and the way that they register, but two, because me having a conversation with people, most of them are very minimal English, so on a visa of some description, And, you know, I believe the government's done a phenomenal job in what they're doing with finance packaging, but there is a gap. And international students, but also workers who had two or three casual jobs, and they just aren't registered in the way they need to be with our government. So showing up and word gets out there. Last week we had a whole huge Afghan community out in the southeast. A lot of them are Spanish speaking in the city, and out in our Geelong campus, primarily a lot of Indian and other students that are down at the university down in Geelong.
You've been a multicultural church from the beginning, Neil, which has been impressive. In terms of this responding in crisis, are you seeing cultural groups that you hadn't as a church had contact with coming because of the need?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we obviously don't discriminate in any way, and it's not based on faith that people come. But in our Southeast campus, there was over 300 people that were connected to, and well over 100 would have been Afghani, actually from the Muslim faith. And, you know, many women coming in their burqas and the whole, well, obviously from a Christian faith perspective, we haven't necessarily connected with those people. But when you've got need, it doesn't discriminate, I guess. You know, we're not going to discriminate on that basis. But then also in our Northeast campus, which is in the Eltham area, which would be a more middle to upper class area. Out of the woodwork has come a lot of workers who have worked in the cleaning industry particularly, and a lot of Spanish-speaking Colombians. So definitely we've started to connect with people that we've never had connection with at this point.
What sort of response are you getting from the people that you're coming across? How do they react to your initiative there?
Well, look, you know, there's a mixture there. Many people that we have had coming through are obviously people that, you know, have probably had a lifetime. I don't like to use the word lifestyle, but they've definitely had a lifetime of need. And so they're trapped in the poverty trap. Whereas this time, we're getting people that would probably be, particularly some of these internationals, that would be more middle class people. So as they're coming in, my observation is at first they don't necessarily want to talk. They don't want to, because there's probably a level of shame, but food is a basic need. And when you need it, you need it. And so we're observing that people are coming in because, for example, one man came in and looked reasonably well dressed. But as he walked out the door, the team observed that he cracked open the bag and started eating. And they were it was quite obvious that he hadn't had any food for some time. You know, if that happened to me or your average person in average Australia, there is probably a little bit of shame associated with that as well. So we're trying to do everything to make sure that it doesn't discriminate even between classes, because some people just aren't used to being in that situation. But as a church, you know, our primary driver, you know, we would use the terminology to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And maybe a lot of that happens in words. And there's a great old saying by Francis of Assisi, you know, the gospel, if you have to use words, so be it. But in essence, we probably have moved across a little to being more, how do we do this with our hands and feet rather than with our words? And that's been liberating, but also maybe a little different, put us in a different frame of how we feel, how we understand, how we do church. But hey, I love change, and it's been a great moment. And again, I want to highlight, we don't want to go, wow, look at the numbers that have grown. Maybe as a Pentecostal church, we look at those things, but we want to look at it, hey, look at these lives that have been affected, and we consider it a great privilege that we're positioned to be able to help them this time.
Yeah, and I wonder if you could comment on something you said earlier about delivering and honouring the sense of dignity in each person and the efforts that you make to do that. And I wonder where your faith speaks into that initiative and attempt to do it that way.
Well, totally. I think the core of the gospel message is that all men have fallen short. You know, all men have sinned, all men have done the, you know, and so what we've got to be so careful of is that we don't look through the eyes of our own humanity or the position we find ourselves in, whether that be a class system, a race system, or whatever else. We've got to look through the eyes of, at every point in every person's life, there's a moment where they have a challenge. And I think from our perspective, we want people to go through that challenge feeling supported and not isolating themselves further because of maybe pride or maybe how they're perceived or whatever that the case may be. You know, the greatest of who we are in humanity is when we become the village that we're supposed to be and stand around each other through difficult times. And if we learn anything from Jesus, you know, Jesus would reach down, you know, to the broken, but he'd also have a robust discussion with, you know, the person in the marketplace. And so we've just got to be situational, reach people where they're at. And I guess that's what we understood that, but it gets accentuated in times like this.
Well, that was Neil Smith from Planet Shakers in Melbourne. Now, Tim, I've heard you say that, and not just you, but lots of other people have said that, you know, while we go through this period of isolation, one good kind of practice, if you like, is gratitude, thinking of all the things that you can be grateful for. Is this something you're kind of pushing as a helpful tactic?
No, I think it's a lifestyle, not a tactic. I think gratitude is fundamental to protecting your kids from depression and giving them resilience. If your kids know that they're blessed, that they can make a difference, that they can reach out to others, I think it is the best gift a parent can give to their children. And I say that because I learned it from my father on a teacher's salary, always gave away more than 10% of his income. We're in a three-bedroom weatherboard house. My brother Peter and I shared a bedroom. We weren't wealthy, but he just had a sense he was blessed. And it caused joy in his life. It profoundly marked mine. Because I've observed our culture move to confusing cost of living, those pressures are real, with cost of a lifestyle. And cost of a lifestyle has become, you know, my annual trip to Bali or maybe to Europe. When holidaying down on the Mornington Peninsula when I was kids, we were just as happy. So I think gratitude is an orientation in life and fundamental both to my faith and to being human.
But can everyone find something to be grateful for?
Well, here's the irony, Simon. In my World Vision days, I discovered that the poorest who we existed to serve were the most giving. I discovered in the donor base at World Vision when I was CEO that giving levels were much higher from the poorer postcodes, not from the richer postcodes. And my sense is that people who have lived on the edge of poverty or faced it actually empathize. They say, I know what that is like. I can give. I can reach out to them. I was surprised a number of times. One, I remember I come back from the earthquake in Nepal and homeless in Narre Warren, outer eastern Melbourne, had collected together and taken up a little bit of money and sent it to us for those poor people in Nepal. And these were right. Some single mums who were in caravans. There were some people who were sleeping rough. I was quite amazed by this. So, yep, it's easier and should be easier for those of us who are rich to give, but often we don't. Often it is those who have struggled.
Yeah, so gratitude as a lifestyle and as an orientation. It's good to have someone to be able to thank too, isn't it?
Absolutely. That sense of looking up, you know, we normally only compare up and say someone's doing better than me. As soon as we compare down and see someone who's struggling, we feel gratitude. We go, I'm blessed. Now, comparing anyone's probably a bad idea, but I think we all have something to be grateful for. And in my faith, that's what praise and for me worship is actually about. It's stretching out to God and thanking God for sustaining my life.
This has been Life and Faith from CPX with me, Simon Smart, and Tim Costello coming in from Frankston in Melbourne. We are working hard to contribute to a positive conversation about faith, meaning, the things that matter. Everything we produce here at CPX seeks to do that. And it's all made possible by supporters who donate to us, and we'd love you to consider doing just this. Every bit counts. Go to lifeandfaithpodcast.com to find out more. Next week.
Well, I think it is a very unique experience, really, in human history, to see across such different national settings and cultural settings the same outpouring of community spirit and gratitude and generosity. And it's just hard to imagine this happening in any other context. I guess we are profoundly globally connected. A downside of that is that when there's a disease, it spreads really quickly. But we're also connected in a different way. And I think the digital connection is enabling us to reach out, even in isolation.